Hello and welcome to Thanks for the Memories. You've got a friend in us. This is episode 23, Philadelphia from 1993. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and with us tonight, Mike, to talk about the first of two back-to-back Academy Award-winning films from Mr. Tom Hanks, we have Brian Late Night Rodriguez. Hello, Brian.
Hello. I mean, arguably, I'm the Academy Award winner of the Cage Club Podcast Network, so...
How would you argue that? A counselor, explain it to me like I was 4 years old. Explain how you are the Academy Award winner of this podcast network.
Well, there aren't actually awards, but if they were, I would put myself up for some nominations.
Such as?
Best Supporting Guest Host for my work on Third Time's a Charm.
Yeah.
Sustained?
An unofficial co-host over there.
Sustained.
I don't know. It just sounded right at the time.
No, I just wanted I wanted you to back it up. I mean, we are in court. You know, I sustained. I didn't overrule. I just wanted to hear the why. So we're here to talk about Philadelphia, a film that I had never seen before today. Had either of you seen this before?
I had seen it once in its entirety, but maybe like a decade ago, I guess, like around 05, 06 or something. We have had this on VHS in my house like ever since it came out, but I had never watched it. I mean, we just had it because we had a lot of like Oscar movies and just like popular films and stuff. But yeah, I watched it on VHS like a decade ago, and then I just rewatched it for the show the other night. So that's it, just twice for me.
And Brian, what about you?
I've seen it a bunch of times. This is one of the first, like, adult movies I watched. Obviously, we all watch kids' movies, but then it's like, oh, let me watch a drama when I'm a kid. And this is like...
Sure.
So I've known this movie, like, for forever. Now, obviously, I didn't see it in the theaters or anything like that, but probably late 90s, first time I saw it, and I've seen it from time to time since.
Now, what I thought was kind of fascinating, and this is just on a very personal level, is that I knew what this movie was about. I knew that this was a movie in which Tom Hanks gets AIDS, and I knew the very basic premise of it. But almost everything else about this movie, I would have guessed incorrectly.
Like that it's a courtroom drama? Like, I had forgotten how it's like A Few Good Men almost. Like, and that now I think I like courtroom dramas. Like, they're all so much different than I thought they were.
One of my notes that I took was at the 40-minute mark when we're already in the courtroom. I was like, is this movie going to be 2/3 in a courtroom? Like, I'm on board. Like, yeah, let's do this. Like, I think I knew that Denzel was in there. I did not realize that this was... It feels more like a Denzel movie than it does a Tom Hanks movie. Tom Hanks is obviously great in this movie. He won the Academy Award for this. I don't dispute or think that he shouldn't have. But he kind of... I don't want to say Denzel's better than him, but Denzel is doing way, way more. But, like, Tom Hanks is still top billed, and he still is the best lead actor. And I feel like it's kind of... Not incorrect, but just... It made me sort of question... You know, not that the Oscars are infallible, but it's sort of strange to think that this is a Tom Hanks movie when it really kind of feels like a Denzel movie.
Yeah, I love Denzel in this so much. Like, he's such a strong performer, and I'd forgotten. And I think part of it might be is that we are so keyed into Hanks that, like, we just may not notice. Like, I think they're pretty evenly split. Like, this movie is a half and half, I think. But, like, we might be noticing Denzel more because he's new here. Like, he's really popping. Like, he almost steals this movie. Almost, and he's got a really powerful performance and everything, but yeah, like, I love what everyone's doing here, but he, for me, like, really got me energized.
The other thing that I would have gotten incorrect about this movie is that for some reason I was under the impression that Tom Hanks was not gay in this movie, that he contracted HIV through some other method, and I thought that was kind of going to be, in a sense, like, I thought his story would be the story of the woman that they called to the stand who had HIV, who was not fired because she was sort of open about it, the one who got HIV for the blood transfusion. And I don't know why I thought that, but, you know, reading more about it after I watched the movie and, you know, reading into the trivia and reading into the sort of the reception, the backlash, and the, you know, the positives and the negatives of this, I didn't realize, I don't think, that this was kind of like, this is like a hallmark, landmark gay film that is both important but also kind of criticized by the gay community for not necessarily being completely accurate. So I think there's a lot to unpack here. But Mike, if you want to hit us first with the plot summary of a relatively straightforward movie.
I forget every time we're doing the plot summaries now, but I got this. No problem.
Go for it.
Tom Hanks is like a really high profile lawyer. He's like pretty young in a group of like older gentlemen that are like running this law firm, and he's being groomed. He's definitely being groomed, but he also has HIV. And when his firm finds out about that, they fire him, and he goes to Denzel Washington, who is kind of just like, you know, one of those lawyers you see on TV, and you don't, you know, an ambulance chaser. I used to tease my brother, the lawyer, about that.
He's a real Saul Goodman type.
Yeah, he kind of is, like a Better Call Saul at one point. But he goes to him, and he takes Tom Hanks's case, and together they fight and win, and just in time, because, like, right as soon as they get the verdict, Tom Hanks passes away. And but they win before he dies, and yeah, it's pretty heavy, man. That's the gist of it, I'd say.
Yeah. I think the one other thing to point out is that Denzel Washington is not really fully on board that Tom Hanks goes to him. He's the ninth lawyer he goes to, and Denzel says no, and then only when he sees Tom Hanks being discriminated against by that, you know, the librarian, that's when he kind of sympathizes a little bit. But even still through that, he is still kind of outwardly homophobic. He gay bashes a little bit, like he uses, you know, slurs and stuff. Like, he's not this bastion of goodness. I think by the end, he is more sympathetic to the plight of the gay man, especially the gay man in early 90s, where, you know, it's truly, not that any of us have any direct experience there. I also feel like having three straight dudes talk about this movie is not necessarily the most reflective panel of experts, quote unquote experts. But not that, like, today is a great time to be gay, but, you know, compared to 26 years ago, we've come a long way.
Or at least to have, like, you know, HIV, gay or not, right? Like, people were just dropping left and right, and yes, there was no survival rate, like, even in the mid-90s, so, like, that has come so far.
Because, like, there's a stat, and just to sidetrack for a second, there's a stat that was kind of refuted a little bit, but it's not wildly inaccurate, that there's something like 53 gay men who are performers in this movie in some regard, either as background actors or sort of more featured players or whatever, and within a few years, like, people said within a year, but it was actually closer to a few years, within a few years of this coming out, more than 40 of them had died. And that's just a staggering number. I think it's indicative of a time, but I just want to make it clear to anybody who has not seen this movie, and it is on Netflix. If you want to watch this movie, you can go see it on Netflix, that Denzel is not, like, a good guy. He just kind of, like, he goes home and he just, like, talks shit on gay guys, you know, to his wife. And he's using the hard F a lot, and, like, it feels real, but it's also, like, wow, okay.
It's tough to watch at times. Yeah, it's heavy. It doesn't shy away or stray from the way people were actually thinking back then. And you know, we reflect upon a lot of this now in the films that we watch from this era and beforehand, and are just like, how could, you know, that's the way it was. Like, it's just amazing. Not what was acceptable, but just what was being said, I guess, in public and stuff. And I wish Denzel's journey in this was a little more clear cut, because I wanted to know when he was actually on his side or when he was just chasing the paper. You know, like, at first it just feels like, oh, this is going to be a high profile case, but then at some point, at the end at least, I feel like he's overcome that sort of prejudice or something, or what, you know, like, he's changed. Like, I feel like there's a genuine understanding between them there. So I feel like that is a little, could have been a little clearer, but it's heavy all around, man. Like, this was not an easy movie for me to watch.
And Joey, I'm going to contradict you a little bit as saying this was an important movie in the gay community. And okay, yes, it was, but I think where this stands the test of time is how important it is in the straight community.
Sure.
Like, this is the first eyes into that kind of community. And does it come off as an after-school special sometimes? Maybe. And in terms of, like, the backlash, it's gone back and forth. It was, like, really praised when it came out, and then, like, it really went through the runner. Kind of like what Forrest Gump is going through now. Oops, can't talk about that yet. But now I think people are more and more understanding, okay, so this is just a very important film for the time it came out in. My mother's someone who was in New York in the 80s working. She had coworkers who were, like, dying of AIDS left and right. And for her, this was a very important film because it's like, oh, okay. And the Denzel thing, it's so weird to watch now, and it's like, oh my god. But that's really, that was the eyes of, like, 90% of the straight population at the time. That is 100%, like, what they felt.
That's where I don't exactly know, and because I was 5 when this movie came out, and I am not as well-versed in the history of the gay community as I should be, and it's 26 years later, and I just don't really have the articulation, the insight into, a lot of this feels like it could be real. A lot of it feels, I think, like you're saying, like, kind of like an after-school special, and I think it kind of bridges the gap between a lot of different types of ways that you could look at this movie or create this movie. And I think to a certain extent, and it's still happening, I think, today in different types of film, different, you know, representations of different communities, that you kind of unfortunately have to make a few sacrifices or whatever, however you want to phrase it, to get the movie to be made on a mainstream budget, right? Like, you can't really have a mainstream Hollywood film 2 years after the director makes Silence of the Lambs, like, one of the most you know, well-regarded and highest-profile films of all time, you know, starring a up-and-coming star, you know, starring two up-and-coming stars, really. Like, to get all of this, the budget, the names, the actors, the director, all of that, I think you kind of need to hedge your bets a little bit, unfortunately. That's what I was trying to figure out, trying to suss out through the entire movie, is how much of this was genuine and a real reflection of the time and the sentiment and the moods, and how much was kind of, this is what people think it is because it's going to make it a little bit more palatable for mainstream. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not trying to be, like, offensive in any way. Like, I think you need to make concessions sometimes to have a movie like this, because, like, to tell the important story, you kind of have to, like, neutralize it or neuter it a little bit.
Well, as far as I know, Jonathan Demme is a straight man, right? So automatically, this is through the filter of a straight man's eyes, you know? So, like, it's never really going to be as inside baseball as it wants to be. And I always feel like it's sort of 50-50 again. It's like, you know, the committee is in charge here, but they know that this is going to be like Oscar bait, like back in the day. Like, this is going to be a big, important project. We want to do it right and carefully. But, like, we also, it's also a mainstream Hollywood movie starring two huge stars and, like, all this other nonsense. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's still like a business movie. It's not just an art film. So, like, you're saying, Joy, like, they have to make concessions. They may not get everything right. They're eyeballing a few of the facts or details or things, and they definitely have a better handle on the straight community than the gay community, because those are just the people making the movie, you know? Like, it would be terrific if there was more behind-the-scenes involvement from the homosexual community in this film, but, I mean, just that, you know, even today, it's hard to get those kinds of films made by people in those positions and stuff. So, like, just imagine, like, if this is the best they could do at the time, I think they did a really good job.
Brian, I want you to tell me, like, before we get into our favorite and least favorite moments and all that good stuff here, like, what about this movie? Is it just the performances? Like, what about this movie brings you back time after time? Like, you said that you've seen it a bunch. You saw it, like, this is one of the first. Maybe it's just the memories of seeing an adult film when you were younger, but, like, this doesn't feel like the kind of movie that I really want to watch again. But, like, what about this encourage you to sign up for it? What has brought you back to watch it more than once? You know, what about this movie? And I guess this could also kind of transition to your, you know, your favorite part of the movie. Like, what about this do you love?
I mean, it is the performances. I mean, I know you said besides the performances, but, I mean, come on. If this was acted by crappy people, it would be that kind of after-school special, but it has a great director and great actors. I mean, that's really important to me. I love Tom Hanks. That's why I'm on this show. I also like AIDS movies. Not, like them, I enjoy them, you know? But I'm very interested in the history of this disease that was such an important part of recent history, and how the story is told. And like I said, this is a really, really important building block in, I don't know what it's called in film, but in history, it's called historiography. Like, if you look at a biography or something written, in the back it'll show where did the author research from, you know? Not really a bibliography, but like what books they took from. Like, this is so important in terms of, if you're building a catalog of, for lack of a better word, AIDS films and how that story is told, this is one of the most important films. And just to touch on what you guys were saying that too, I'm sure there were artsy AIDS films at the time made by people in the gay community, but those weren't being watched by mainstream America. In fact, I'm sure they were turning away from them. Is this film perfect? No, but again, this is just a landmark film.
So what about this do you like more than anything else? I mean, I know you said Tom Hanks, but like, what if you had to pick a favorite part, a favorite moment, scene, line, memory of this movie, what would you say is your favorite part of Philadelphia? Which I know is very difficult, because it's not a kind of a movie. It's not like a movie where like, I really like that part where he died of AIDS.
Right, right. No, it's not like Denzel is chasing anybody in this movie with a gun, right? Like, it's like you usually see him.
Yeah, and it's not like, yeah, I mean, Denzel's got some good moments, but it's not like at the end of Man on Fire, he's like, I wish you had more time. It's like, yeah, fuck yeah, Denzel, let's do that. But like here, just like, oh yeah, him calling that guy like a hard F, like that's not my favorite moment, I can tell you that much.
I mean, I do like some of those moments though. Like, I do like, I mean, not that again I enjoy it, but I think it
was, yeah, right, I know.
I think it was pretty indicative again of the time. Like, it's funny, but it's interesting, I guess is the way to say it. Like, they have to tell the straight American audience that you don't have to look gay to be gay. You know, I find that interesting. Like, it's not great, but I find it interesting that, like, I'm thinking about how this movie is being viewed at the time while I'm watching it. I'm not necessarily watching it just for the story, because I know the story already. I'm thinking about someone sitting in a writer's room and writing it and being like, huh, well, we don't want them to think this, so let's put a character in like this, like the law student he runs into at the pharmacy or whatever. That kind of stuff is just interesting to me. One of my favorite moments, though, and Honestly, and maybe this is sacrilege to some people, I'm not a Bruce Springsteen fan, but this is one of my two favorite Bruce Springsteen songs. And the other one is a Tom Club song too, the one from Jerry Maguire. So I love that the synergy in this, these two Springsteen soundtrack songs.
Well, we also do, just on the real quick, and I know, Mike, you have a thought to say, but on the real quick thought of synergy, at one point in here when I think the lead juror is talking about his pilot metaphor, he's like, no, I'm going to put my Top Gun in that pilot. It's like, hell yeah, you are.
It's true.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to jump the gun or anything, but I think that song might be my least favorite thing about this movie.
I love it.
The one thing, I remember it so much from when this came out and all the hoopla about it and Springsteen, and I mean, I'm not going to say I think Springsteen's overrated or anything like that, but yeah, I just couldn't. It was depressing enough, and then I just did not like that song.
The Academy Award winning song, Streets of Philadelphia, and Golden Globe Award. So he apparently wrote Tunnel of Love, and then Jonathan Demme rejected that, and then had him rewrite different themes and such for Streets of Philadelphia. But yeah, Academy Award winning song, Mike, that you are disliking.
It's such a sign of the times. I love soundtracks. I love soundtrack songs. It's so depressing. It just really sticks out to me.
Well, it's the perfect tone, and he's the perfect guy to do it. Like, this is I could see Springsteen doing a whole album like this, and you know, but like, he had to rock it up. If you listen to his lyrics, they are like this hometown sort of struggle stuff, so it fits. I'll say that
this is the era too where, like, when they commission a soundtrack, they are playing that in the background a bunch of times, so it's funny.
Oh yeah, it becomes part of the score almost. It's like a theme variation.
You gotta get your money's
worth on. Yeah.
All right, Mike, so if that's one of your least favorite parts, what is your favorite part of this movie? What do you really like about this movie?
Okay, so I love the cinematography of this. So Tak Fujimoto, I believe that's how you pronounce his name. This is Jonathan Demme's cinematographer since forever. And he shot the John Adams series. If you've ever seen that, it's just incredible. Like, he is just great. And what I love about their style together is, like, you know, and you see this a lot, I think, in The Silence of the Lambs, and he sort of tapered off a little bit after this movie. But the use of the shot, like the use of close-up, and the use of perspective, and I just really feel like he's able to switch gears and get inside other characters' heads very quickly by using camera perspective and things like that. And so there's just so many great close-ups in this.
My first note is that Jonathan Demme really loves a close-up. Like, I rewatched part of Silence of the Lambs a couple of months ago, and I was like, oh, like, this entire movie is just like uncomfortable close-ups putting you in the mind of those characters.
And I feel like it works here because he wants you to be uncomfortable. Like, not just like Denzel's uncomfortable, but also like Hanks is uncomfortable. Like, everybody is uncomfortable in this movie, right? Like, no matter what, from one way or the other. And I think that helps sort of psychologically offset the viewer, or at least it helped me be like, wow, like, I'm really being drawn attention to the way that this movie's shot, and it's sort of throwing me off, and it's not quite reality, but it's very grounded. And so, like, I just really enjoyed watching the cinematography. It's been a while, I feel, since it's really something like that's really jumped out at me in like a modern film per se. A lot of modern film, I don't know, I feel like they try to be too flashy when they're flashy, and like, this isn't necessarily flash, it's just style, and I think it married really well with the content here, so I'm gonna go with that.
Yeah, I think, because I mean, it is like a very intimate film. It's an intimate story. It's the story of one man. I mean, it's also Jeffrey Bauer is the guy who that this was actually based upon, his you know, wrongful termination, his lawsuit. So it is very personal, and how do you reflect that in the camera work is, yeah, just the up close in your face nature of it. I think that's a great point, Mike. One of my favorite moments was when Denzel serves papers to Charles Whittier when they're at the basketball game, and Dr. J comes in, and he's, you know, just, you know, glad handing. He's just like, hey guys, how's it going? How's it going? How's it going? And then Denzel just like brushes by the security guard. He's like, it's only gonna take a minute. He's like, you've been served. Oh, Dr. J, if you ever need a lawyer, here you go. Like, wrong, you know, you slip and fall or whatever. Just like, still hustling there. And then just says, see you in court, and he just walks out. I'm like, that's so cool. Like, that's like the Denzel moment. You know what I mean? Like, that's the, you know, that's the him, like, just, you know, flexing those acting muscles, but also just the power muscles, the manliness muscles or whatever, the Denzel charm, the Denzel thing that he's come to be known for.
Yeah, just that smile, that hey. Like,
yeah.
Like, every time someone does a Denzel impression, I feel like they're always doing like him kind of laughing, like, ha-ha, like, you can't resist me.
One other moment that I really liked, because I really like Mary Steenburgen, and I have never seen her in something before that I didn't like her in, like, her character. Like, I'm always on her side or whatever. And here, I was just so disappointed in her as like the kind of the lead one, of the co-lead lawyer, you know, prosecutor or defense attorney for the law firm. And I was just like, God damn it. Like, you're failing me, Mary Steenburgen. Like, I love you and you're failing me. And then after she pulls the mirror trick, the mirror stunt, and she goes back, she turns to her co-counsel and she says, I hate this case. And you can tell that it's her job to do this, and she's going to do it the best she can, but she's not a monster. That she, like, hates what she's doing. She hates, like, the circus that she has to pull here to sort of, you know, this isn't, like, it's the theatrics of it. Like, can you show me, like, if I was looking at you, like, I can't tell that you're gay, or, you know, like all that kind of stuff. Apparently what I was reading was that was something that was not in the script, that Jonathan Demme and she were talking about how to sort of humanize her. And she was saying to, you know, other actors on set how much she, like, hated playing this character because she just hated being such a villain. And he's like, well, use that, like, say that, like, make her more than just this one-dimensional, like, enemy. Like, say that you hate the case. And I thought that was a really kind of great moment, especially seeing it in the movie. Like, I think that is great. But then kind of knowing the backstory and knowing the look inside the actor's mind or whatever, I think that's also, it makes it even better.
Yeah, that's a good call. I like that moment a lot, too, because, like, I'm watching that OJ show on Netflix right now that was on FX, like,
a
year or two ago.
It'll always be your Uncle Juice.
And it's like... Like, nobody has any qualms about trying to get Juice off, you know? And I just want one character with a moral quandary of, like, maybe Juice isn't, like, maybe we shouldn't be doing it. But no, like, everyone on his team is just like, we're getting Juice off.
Eventually, Schwimmer as Kardashian definitely feels that.
Okay, all right. I'm not sure I'm there yet, but, like...
Spoiler alert, but... You're going to be okay, Mike. I'm saying you're going to be okay.
It's just like, it's such a small little moment you can sneak in there that says, that speaks volumes, you know? And it was put in here perfectly.
So on the flip side of the coin, Brian, what about this movie do you not like? I mean, aside from obviously the homophobia, like, taking aside the character flaws that are intentional to this plot, what about this movie as a movie do you not like? Is there something about here that sort of sticks out that you don't like revisiting? Like, what about this do you not like?
While watching it this time, I was kind of disappointed that this is not actually based on a true story. You mentioned that Bowers case. There was another case that they took some notes from. But, like, there's so many real true stories, especially at this time, that I don't know if they had to make one up. That's a little weird. But, yeah, I guess there's that. There's a lot of this movie that's not necessarily I hate, but it's stuff that I continue to go back and forth and question. There are a lot of stereotypes, and I've tried to look into this. I've tried to see, like, how do people want to be portrayed, like, here, like, the gay community. And there's a lot of people who criticize, like, Antonio Banderas' character for being very stereotypical. And then there was a big movement after this and after a couple films in this era to try to go opposite of that. But then I've heard criticisms like, when you sterilize it too much, you lose what, like, gay culture actually is. So watching it this time, I actually didn't mind his performance. I wish they were, like, more intimate at times, because you just kind of see, like, pecks on the cheek and stuff.
Well, there was stuff with that apparently was cut out that the studio did not want in the movie. So that was originally in there, that they were more intimate, that they were more, I don't know if it was sexual, or they were closer, more affectionate, to be sure.
Yeah, because it definitely felt like, despite, like, again, I think he actually, like, does a great performance, but I just would have liked to see them seem more like a couple rather than... It felt very, like, digestible gay culture, which, again, I get it, but it was a little weird.
I don't know. I also feel like, on the one hand, you have Antonio Banderas, and he maybe, I don't know, not for me, I didn't notice it, but, like, people may think he's going too far, but then you have the point of Denzel running into the guy at the store, you know, and it's like, hey, not everybody is the same, like, you know, like, we don't all act the same, not all straight people act the same, like, you know, it's so, I see what you're saying. I wish the movie made a better point about it, but I feel like it tried to sort of balance itself in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that those scenes were cut probably would solve my issue there. Can I tell you something I remembered that I do like?
Yes, of course.
I actually, especially on this watch, really like the fact that, kind of opposite to what you thought the movie might have been, Joey, but I like the fact that he got AIDS. It was, you know, essentially his fault, quote unquote. I mean, no one's fault ever.
Well, he has it when the movie starts, right?
Yes.
Which I was sort of surprised. I thought that this was going to be a movie where he contracts it and then has to deal with it.
Because I'm not sure if he starts with HIV and then it becomes AIDS. Like, that's the one thing,
too. Well, a lot of time passes in this movie. Mm-hmm. So, I agree. Like, I'm not sure where that happens either, Mike. But, like, I don't know that it's necessarily important. important. Like, one of the first scenes is him in the clinic, right, getting a blood test, and him calling his mom, and I was just like, wait, is he already, wait, what? I feel like if you don't know what this movie is about, like, if you go in this movie, like, really cold.
Like, you think it's a documentary about Philadelphia.
Maybe, I don't know, like, I feel like you wouldn't know for kind of for a while. You sort of need a little bit of backstory, like, you need even, like, the one-sentence logline, because they do slow play it, which I think works, but it's also, like, without really knowing what it's about, it's like, wait, is he already, wait, what?
Well, someone at the time would have known right away when he's having the conversation with the mother and they're talking about the T-cell count and the names of the medication. Like, that was buzzword news at the time. So today it's, like, a little bit harder to figure out. But at the time they would have been filled in right away, like, oh, he definitely has AIDS. Also, all the patients in that room, it's clearly an AIDS clinic. He started to get the sores, which is not, you know, something that's very common today. But at the time, that was, like, the telltale sign of the later stages of AIDS. I forgot what the exact disease is called.
I have it here. Hold on. So Andrew Beckett, Tom Hanks' character, dies from acute CMV, which is cytomegalovirus. A common cause of death in acute AIDS patients. His lesions are caused by Kaposi's sarcoma, also common in AIDS patients at the time.
It was a very, very, very rare disease before, like, the AIDS epidemic. That started appearing, and people were like, what the hell? So, like, that was one of the first, like, things in the news. Like, why are these gay men getting this rare disease that only, like, random people got in one place on Earth ever? So I think at the time, a lot of those, like, wait, what's going on, would have been solved right away. Because you used to go on this, according to, like, someone like my mother, again, who was living in the city and working during this time. Like, you used to be on the subway and see people who looked just like, I mean, maybe not Tom Hanks, because he's obviously made up, but they used, as you mentioned, actual people who had HIV and AIDS in the film. And that was just, like, unfortunately and sadly a very common look at the time. So, you know, within context, that makes sense. Oh, but what I was going to say was, again, I liked that it was his quote-unquote fault, that it wasn't that he had a blood transfusion. It wasn't that, like, someone did give it to him, but, like, they make it clear that, like, it was him.
It was promiscuous sex, like, in a porn house, right? Like, he went to, like, a club or something, or a theater, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he did that, but I don't know if that's where he got it from, though, right?
Oh, no. But, okay, so on the stand, they ask if he has ever visited there. I sort of assume that.
Yeah, because earlier, like, when they're in the basketball, they're in the, you know, the tunnels underneath the NBA arena, they're just talking about, like, well, what other gay hotspots do we know he's been to? Like, how can we make him look bad? Like, has he ever had, you know, sex with a strange man in this place or this place or this place? Like, I think that's just sort of demonizing him that, like, oh, as an upstanding citizen, as a straight man, I would never go have sex with a stranger in a porn theater. Like, of course not. But you, clearly, you know, like, it's just, like, I think it's that, like, it might have happened there, but it doesn't.
It's unspecific. They're just trying to, like, defame him. Yeah.
Like, he just, you know, was kind of living his life. Yeah.
Yeah, and I liked that, though. Like, not that they were doing that. You know what I mean? I liked that he wasn't, like, a saint. He wasn't, like, the perfect guy that we're just supposed to. Of course we feel bad for him. Of course. But he is just someone living his life like anyone else. I don't know, it gave another layer. Like, that took it down from the after-school special, which I liked, that he wasn't just this perfect lawyer who happened to get AIDS and, you know, because that wouldn't have been, there's no stakes in that almost.
Right, because they're trying to change, like, a precedent here, you know? Like, they're trying to change points of view and society, like, morals and standards, and everything, like, mores, and right? But this case, like, and I hear what you're saying, it's too bad that this wasn't. Now that I think about it, I agree, I wish it was more of a real case, but if it has to be an amalgam of them, that's fine. But I like the point of the film, though, because you're right, he's trying to change, like, the prejudice and the standard, and, you know, this is an important case, and if he was a straight man that just contracted it through a transfusion, there, yeah, it would not have the meaning that it does. So, and it would not be as profound.
Yeah, like an early AIDS movie is called The Ryan White Story, which was a TV movie, and that was, like, really what got a lot of people, like, talking about, like, the AIDS thing. But The Ryan White Story is about, like, a little boy who contracts it, I believe, through, like, he's a hemophiliac. So he contracts it through that, I believe, in, like, a blood transfusion or something along those lines. So, and that movie was more saying, look, it's not just the gays that get AIDS, guys. It's everybody, you know? And I'm not criticizing that, because it's true.
Well, I think that's also what this movie does with the woman who gets it from the transfusion, right? Like, it's just, you know, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, and they try to, as you see in this movie, the defense tries to be like, this is a good one, you know? But I think that was put in here because of the Ryan White story.
Okay.
You know?
What year was that movie?
89.
Okay, okay.
So that, like, yeah, there are people like this. Yeah, they are innocent. And how, you know how she starts saying, how am I different than him? I don't see it. I forgot her exact words, but it's really, like, nice, you know? Like, just because he's a gay man who contracted it this way, and I'm someone who contracted it in a blood transfusion, I don't see myself different than him. We're both sufferers of this disease.
Yeah, I mean, she does not have a ton of screen time, but I think she's really one of the most sympathetic characters because she's really up there. She's trying. You know what I mean? Like, she's trying to do right by him and by the people who are afflicted with this disease, and she's just trying to, like, tell her story in a way that can defend him, and just she just looks defeated by the way the defense twists her words to fit their narrative, right? And, like, it's heartbreaking to see her up there. You know, another woman who obviously did not, again, like, you know, that should not have to deal with this, but because she lost too much blood while giving birth, she got a transfusion, she got AIDS, so on and so forth, and it just, you know, she just looks so beaten down by the system, because all she wants to do is help and make sure, you know, this guy that, you know, whether she's friends with him or just knows him or knows of him or whatever, you know, that he gets his fair due, and it's just, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's one of the most powerful, you know, scenes in the movie.
Yeah, I really love that type of moment where it's almost like the defense kind of backfires, but not exactly. It's like they put this woman on the stand, and everything she's, like, saying is good for them, but the way she's saying it is kind of bad. Like, her expressions and her demeanor and, like, her meaning behind it and all that kind of thing, and it's like, I don't know, it's great. It just, because it just reminds you of sort of the conundrum going on here. It's like, she's a prop by them being used, and yet she also is a person going through the same types of experience with this disease and stuff, and so the double standard and the bias and all that kind of stuff comes to the surface in this moment again, but all together, you know, because she's a straight woman, he's a gay man, like all of the themes I feel like kind of are converging around this moment too. So
Mike, if you had to pick a least favorite moment, what about this movie, I mean, aside from the Bruce Springsteen song, what about this movie does not work well for you? What about this movie would you change or swap out or alter in some way?
It's tough. Like, I feel like it's really well crafted. I feel like it's got a really tight script going on. And, like, the things I don't like about it, I'm, like, not really supposed to like about it, right? Like, the things that are offending me are there intentionally. And I think that's making it a stronger movie. But what really kind of got me, and again, I've only seen this movie twice, so I don't have, like, the best, like, grip on it exactly. But I don't think the passage of time is shown very well, or like in a paid attention to in the manner that it may have should have been. I think we get some title cards from time to time.
Yeah, there's a bunch of title cards.
That's the I don't know. I couldn't really keep track of seasons, years, times, months, and things like that. And ultimately, it's I guess it doesn't matter. But I feel like it would have given it more of an impact. We do go to a Halloween party. Like, I thought that was a nice touch, right? Like, that was what I was talking about. I was like, oh, cool. Like, did we celebrate Christmas? I can't, you know, it's things like that. Like, I wanted all the kind of, this was supposed to be going on for a long time. I didn't really feel like it was going on for a long time. And so, like, that's kind of like my only gripe about it right now is, like, and I feel like that's kind of a big thing directorially, but I understand how much other shit was probably on their mind making this movie and all the concessions they had to make to the studios and all the things they wanted to get in and the time and this and that and all that. So, like, I could see how it sort of got maybe, like, just not as actualized as I would have liked it. So, like, that's pretty much the only thing while I was watching it this time.
You know, if I had to pick a least favorite moment, I think, other than, like, maybe what we've talked about, let me see if there's anything else. Like, I think in terms of the time, early on in the movie, I liked the rapid pace. I liked the quickening. I liked the frenetic energy that this seemed to have. Like, it felt like it was rocketing through to some end game, end goal, end date. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like there was an excitement here. And then I feel kind of like you feel like that as it went on, it kind of it lost a little bit of the clarity, perhaps, in when things were happening. But I do want to say that I think early on it worked, or at least it was exciting to me, that I thought this might be like a slower moving kind of movie. And it felt like for a while, we're getting toward where we need to go. And I thought that worked well early on. I also think early on, there's a real dreamlike quality to a lot of this. And you don't know exactly, like, everything's real, but it's all kind of twisted and warped, and I think there's something nice in a way about that, like something that this is not, like, you sort of question things, right? Like, it's don't just accept things, like, think about things, use critical thinking, use analysis, sort of dig deeper and try to make sense of what's going on here. I don't know if there's anything else about this movie that I don't like that we haven't already said.
Oh, I've thought of one thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And it's not that I dislike it, but I thought it was kind of, now that we're talking about this movie and how, you know, it does come across as a little Hallmarky or whatever like that. Like, okay, so I feel like when Hanks and Denzel have that scene in the beginning, right? And they're in the elevator together and they're just two people in law world passing in the wind.
Yep.
I wish that kind of had more significance. Like, I wish we found out that Hanks was waiting to go to Denzel, like he was putting it off or something, like he didn't want to have to resort to that, because it doesn't seem that way. It seems like almost like they were friends or something. Like, I don't know. I could have, maybe even if we didn't need that scene in the opening. And again, it's not something I hate. It's just something I watch in this movie. It's like, oh, they already met? Like, they know each other or something? Or like, are they colleagues? Like, it just made me a little more confused that when they re-meet, they're not more friendly, and, you know, he doesn't understand, like, oh, he didn't know you have AIDS? Like, that kind of threw me.
I'll piggyback off that for a second, because I was confused. I was like, is this a flash forward? Like, it kind of felt like, is this what they're working toward? Because I knew that they're, you know, they were in this together in some regard. But no, it's just like, they worked together. They were on the same case once. And I think it's just there to establish there was a history. But I think it's strange, and what you're saying, Mike, that there's not more to it. Like, it's not like, not there really could be less of setting up a relationship, but like, it should be either, I think, less or more. Because I feel like the, at least maybe putting it first in the movie kind of sets it up as this sort of, how do you want to say it, false importance, kind of? It's like, oh, there's meaning here, there's significance to this. And it doesn't necessarily have meaning, other than just they know each other.
Yeah, it's just they're both lawyers.
But like, we also see in the movie that, like, when Hanks is walking through the clinic, I think, we see Denzel on TV. And I think, I mean, I guess this could also kind of be the thing where maybe this is actually how the real story was or whatever, right? But I think there would also be kind of something, not necessarily comical to the fact, but that he has exhausted all of his options. He has gone to every quote-unquote real lawyer. They've all said no for one reason or another. And maybe we see that too. Like, I don't want to necessarily make this movie too much longer, because I think it works at the length that it is, but maybe show him going other places and have like a quick montage of why people are saying no, and then he sees a bench ad or a billboard ad or the TV commercial, and it's just like, well, shit, like, I guess I'll try this guy. And then even he says no. You know what I mean? Like, I think there could be something to, like, I don't know if he's going to Denzel because he respects him, or if he's the last option, or because he thinks he can do it. Like, I don't know the why of that. And I think that's also what you're saying. Like, I want kind of an explanation of what actually, like, what the thought process is, why he's in Denzel's office. Did he go to other people after Denzel, or is he going to take the case himself? Like, is he in the law library studying so that he can defend himself? Like, I don't know where in the, I think I agree, the TLDR is, like, I want more clarity, or less clarity, in the beginning, kind of, with his relationship with Denzel. Like, why is this the way that it is?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can agree with that. Though I think it's pretty clear that he was going to defend himself, because, you know, he's like, what he says that line along the lines of, like, oh, I'm a pretty good lawyer. I think it was out of last resort. I think MTV, though, would disagree with you guys in terms of, I don't know, are you not liking the duo of Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks?
Did this win an MTV VMA?
No, it was nominated for Best, which feels so inappropriate. Let me see. Best on-screen duo, Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington.
All right, 93, you got Tom Hanks and Denzel. You got Wayne Knight and the T-Rex.
Wayne and Garth, probably.
There's another Hanks film that's best on-screen duo, which is Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks in Sleepless in Seattle.
Oh, of course. Yeah, we mentioned last episode that in the Golden Globes, which he won the Best Actor Drama for, he was nominated for both drama and comedy. Like, he could have won both, which
would have been great.
Yeah. Who are the other duos?
So the winner was Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones from The Fugitive.
Oh, my God.
Which, again, is not really a duo. Like, I
no,
guess it's like...
it would be like Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith from Men in Black.
There's, yeah, that's more of a duo, yeah.
Okay, but keep going. Yep.
Mary Stuart Masterson and Johnny Depp from Benny and June. Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington from Philadelphia. Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks from Sleepless in Seattle. And Dana Carvey and Mike Myers from Wayne's World 2.
Oh, boy, what a weird category, man.
All right, I will mention the other things that Philadelphia was nominated for at the MTV Movie Awards.
Okay. Oh, there was more?
Yeah.
Best Kiss? No.
God. Tom Hanks won for Philadelphia Best Male Performance. Thank you, teenagers.
Okay.
Whoa. He beat Tom Cruise, your other boy, in The Firm.
For The Firm, yeah. Okay. Another law movie the same
wow.
year.
Wow. Rough year for MTV.
Harrison Ford, The Fugitive, Val Kilmer for Tombstone, and Robin Williams, Mrs. Doubtfire.
Robin Williams lost?
How did Mrs. Doubtfire not win for the teens? Like, how was that?
Especially, yeah, MTV.
While we were on the topic of awards, this is the most recent time, I think, that two actors who won back-to-back acting awards were in the same movie together. Hanks won for this and Forrest Gump, and Jason Robards won for All the President's Men and Julia. He won Best Supporting Actor for both of those. So this is like two, you know, kind of heavy-hitting actors in the same movie, because that doesn't happen too often as it is back-to-back years, and then for two of them to be in the same movie, even less common.
You know who else I saw in this movie is a cameo by Roger Corman himself.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna ask that. I saw his name in the title sequence. I'm like, Corman strikes again? Explain, who was he?
So he was, if I'm not mistaken, on the stand, he was the guy Denzel was like, was he a good lawyer? Did he win your case? And he was like, he was an adequate lawyer. He was like, all right. And he was like, you wrote that he was like the best lawyer in the world or whatever.
And surprised and delighted.
Yeah, and he just sits there sort of on the stand stone-faced. And then later there's a flashback scene where Tom Hanks is talking about like some of the jokes he overheard at the country club or something. And he tells a horrible, horrible joke that is just terrible. But there he is. He's in the movie. I mean, he gave Jonathan Demme his start. So this was sort of like a little thank you, I guess.
Some other quick trivia before we play a couple games, which feels like a wildly inappropriate way to wrap up a podcast about this movie. The home videos that they're watching at the end are actually of Tom Hanks as a child, so that's why it kind of looked like young Tom Hanks, because it was Tom Hanks.
It's hard to see through the tears.
Tom Hanks lost 26 pounds to play this role. Denzel was asked to gain a couple pounds to play this role, and he apparently taunted Tom Hanks by eating candy bars directly in front of him.
Hanks is going to lose a lot of weight again for that shipwreck movie
with the Castaway,
and yeah. Gain a lot of weight for that one.
The movie was filmed in order, which I think is kind of important for a narrative like this, and especially the physical transformation that Tom Hanks is going through for like this. Originally, Jonathan Demme wanted a comedic actor in the Denzel part. He reached out to, or considered reaching out to, Bill Murray or Robin Williams, but Denzel wanted to play the part, and he always wanted to work with Denzel, so he went with Denzel there.
It would be very strange if the Denzel character wasn't a black guy. Like, I feel like that adds such a dimension.
So he was originally written as an Italian-American. John Leguizamo turned down the part of Miguel to do Super Mario Brothers instead, which...
Champion choice right there.
All right.
To get drunk on set with Bob Hoskins for a month?
I agree with that choice.
Jonathan Demme originally wanted Daniel Day-Lewis in the Tom Hanks part. He turned it down to do In the Name of the Father instead. Michael Keaton was the second choice. He turned it down to make My Life instead.
Oh, that's a great movie.
And that was a movie where he was terminally ill, but he had cancer in that movie. So there we go.
I love all those parts that they turned it down to. Like, should I take the AIDS movie or the terminally ill movie? Or am I going to be locked in prison, you know?
The Holocaust film, like, exactly.
Jeez.
They also considered casting an all-male adult film star, like a gay movie star, Jerry Kelly, to give it a little bit more authenticity. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that Soderbergh would do. You know what I mean? Like, actually. I mean, yeah, Sacha Grey has been the star of more than one movie, or at least one movie of his, right?
Girlfriend Experience.
Yep. And I think that's everything I've got trivia-wise. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to read about this, especially, I think, to the backlash and to the, you know, people not necessarily loving it the way that they were supposed to, or like the gay community, for instance. Many gay publications had quite a few issues. Out magazine said it was, quote, maddeningly closeted. There was a lack of dimensionality in the film's gay characters. Many gay viewers felt that Jonathan Demme missed an opportunity to accurately portray someone's experience living with AIDS. Gay activist and playwright Larry Kramer described the film as, quote, dishonest and, quote, simply not good enough. Also, quote, often politically, legally, and medically inaccurate. And I think that kind of comes back to what we were saying before about kind of sort of needing to make concessions to get this movie made at all, which is unfortunate, but, you know, if it's really truly true to life, it might be too real for, you know, anti-woke America in 1993 to watch. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of those criticisms are unfair at all. It's funny because Larry Kramer, of course, wrote the play, and then it turned into an HBO movie, The Normal Heart, that Ryan Murphy directed, that starred Mark Ruffalo. So if you guys out there want to hear or see the Larry Kramer take on this, go watch The Normal Heart on HBO. I really enjoyed it. I don't know how many MTV awards it was nominated for. Ruffalo, I think, won a SAG award for it. I don't know if he won an Emmy. He was nominated for an Emmy, but he didn't win. The movie won the Emmy for Best Television Movie, The Normal Heart. Animal Heart. So I recommend it.
If we imagined the movie Philadelphia starring Tom Cruise, would this work?
I think so. You know what part of it is to me? Any top-notch actor, like any actor of this caliber, which I think Hanks is now of this caliber, and like this proves it, and I think Cruise has been there. If he made it after like Eyes Wide Shut and maybe before Magnolia or something, I don't know. I think he could pull this off, though. He tries to do something like, not like this, but he tries to go like in a weird different direction from what people are used to seeing him in with that Vanilla Sky. So I think this would have been a sort of same type of move where it's like, I'm going to go do something where it's not like I'm good, like a vanity thing where I'm good looking. Like I want to go try and do something important or something, but I think he can do it.
I think what's interesting, and this is something that Brian reminded me of when he was reading the MTV Movie Awards, was the same year that this comes out, Tom Cruise plays a lawyer in The Firm, and not only a lawyer, and I don't want to make this comparison, but I kind of want to say it, is by the end of that, remember how like disheveled and unhealthy he looks? And yes. I feel like there's like the physical transformation, and I know it's not due to an illness, but rather stress and paranoia, and I know it's a completely different type of transformation, but I feel like that going from kind of man who has it all, seemingly has it all, to someone fighting against the system in a courtroom, nonetheless, like he literally does the same thing that year, not necessarily to the acclaim or the extent of this movie, but I think that I would tend to agree with you that I think he could probably do it because he's, you know, say 60% of the way there, and we know that it's in him to kind of take that next leap, right? So, Brian, what about you? Do you think that Tom Cruise could do this?
I think he could. I definitely like it better with Hanks because I think, not that Cruise doesn't do it, but Hanks, I think, does Vulnerable a little bit better. But I think he could, for all the reasons you said, too. He played a disabled person in Born on the 4th of July, right? I'm not comparing the two, but yeah, you're right about The Firm as well. It's not like he hasn't done this. It's more up the Hanks alley, but I could see him doing it for sure.
Yeah, okay. Is there another part in this movie that you think he would be better at than the Tom Hanks role?
I think he could have done, not that it would have been better than Denzel, but I think he could have done the Denzel role. I like it better as a black man. I like it better as Denzel, but I think he could have done that too. I could see him, like, you know, being an hotshot ambulance chaser.
That's a little of You Can't Handle the Truth, a few Good Men. He's such a confident hotshot prick lawyer in that movie, you know, and he's just got the sway and the swagger that I think Denzel is like kind of the same way that he's got it. But I guess like you pick up with like just that charisma, like Johnny Cochran had it, you know what I mean? Like there's just people who can just have it and they're, you know, you can't question it.
Man, you're really on that OJ horse, huh? All right, so very important question, and I don't know what the answer is here. Does Tom Hanks do anything in this movie that sets him on the road to becoming America's dad?
In the movie?
So we're trying to track his journey from, we didn't have this thesis statement when we began. We had the question, but basically going from like 80s goofball wacky actor in like dumb kind of bro comedies to basically becoming named America's dad. Does he do anything in this movie? I feel like the answer is no, but it's not because of him as much as the type of movie that he's in. Like, I feel like it is in terms of thematically or on an importance level or however you want to phrase it, he is closer to the type of movies he will be known for. But I don't know that anything in here really has him becoming more of a family man. Unless, no, wait, better, hold on. He is trying to improve the future for future generations.
See, that's where I was going to go, is like he fights the system and that kind of thing, but he doesn't have any kids, it's nothing direct, it's nothing like imparted to like an actual character or anything like that, but just by his actions and his virtue, you know, like he becomes the kind of man that you would be, you know, I guess you'd be proud if he was your dad, right? Like,
yeah.
He fucking stood up for what he believed in and he won against all odds.
All right.
So I want to be clear, as America, we like our dad. We don't have dad issues.
What? I mean, we like Tom Hanks as our dad.
We like America's
dad.
Okay. Just wanted to make that clear.
In the very early seasons of Never Not Funny, Jimmy Pardo is trying to get his nickname as America's hair dad rolling, and it's not quite catching on in the same way. But every time I think of America's dad, I also think now of America's hair dad, and just wanted to share that with both of you. All right, for the Woodies, the Tom Hanks Awards, best film, worst film, do we want to nominate this for best film?
I mean, Joey, now's the time we got to start making hard decisions because we're in the streak. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're in the lane of, like, good shit only for a while, for the most part.
We can add it for now. Like, I feel like, you know, The Money Pit and The Burbs and Big might not make the cut in the end.
Isn't that amazing that Big isn't going to make the cut? And, like, I never would have imagined it growing up that Big wouldn't be on, like, my top Hanks list, but, like, it... I don't think it's gonna.
I don't know. So best film, we'll say for now, Philadelphia. Best Hanks role, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have to be crazy, like, not to at least have this in the conversation.
I mean, even MTV nominated.
What's his name? Andrew Beckett?
Yes.
Best ensemble, I'm going to say no, just because it kind of feels like most of the movie, it's kind of two people, right? Like, it's Hanks and Denzel, and, like, everybody else, like, at a much lower tier. Hanks does not get into a fight, like, an actual physical altercation in this movie. Does not dance. Party scene.
Wait, he does dance. He dances with his IV, right? He does to the opera? Isn't that what you're thinking?
Oh, yeah. He also does a slow dance with Antonio Banderas. So I'll do the...
Oh, that's it. The Banderas one, too. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I will say, no, I like the operatic dance with the IV.
And then the lights get all crazy. Like, that was a trippy moment.
Best party scene?
Well, Denzel coming... What did he come as again?
A lawsuit.
He's a lawsuit.
It's okay. I like when that one gay guy is, like, hitting on him. He's like, do I know? He's like, yeah, Mona Lisa. Like, duh. Like, that's not the question I'm asking, but, like, I appreciate the answer. I don't want to nominate that for best party scene because I feel like it didn't... Like, I feel like the reason that it existed was not to be a party scene. It was just kind of, like, yes, to get in there and sort of have him in that kind of world, that environment.
And ultimately to go over what they were going to say in court, right? Like, he's like, this is the only time I can catch you. Like, we have to go over this by tonight. So I almost feel like it was a last-ditch effort by Denzel to get a couple hours or, like, a half hour with Hanks, you know, or something, just in private to go over some work.
Best Hanks outfit wardrobe, I'm going to say no. Best death,
Hold on about the best thing, though.
Oh, my God.
He hasn't died yet. I mean, I'm just saying.
Damn, I was not quick enough. I wanted to say something about his best wardrobe, and now it's totally dumb. He dressed up like a captain, and he's going to be a Captain Phillips at some point.
And he's also going to be Sully, so that's also yes, a type of captain.
Does he going to play Captain Crunch one day? That'd be cool.
I'm going to say from CMV in Philadelphia. We got to catalog the deaths. Best line or best freakout? I think maybe one of the more iconic, or maybe just one that I've seen before, I've heard before, his, excuse me, am I being fired? I don't know if that's worthy of best line, but that was one that sort of stuck out to me. Is there something in here that you think we should nominate for best line? Oh, wait. I don't know if I want to nominate it for this, but when Denzel says, what happened to your face? Like, when he first comes into his office and he's just joking around, he's like, what happened to your face? And he just goes, I have AIDS. And Denzel's like, ah, shit. Like, I shouldn't. I feel bad now.
That's a moment.
All right, I'm gonna say that. I'm gonna nominate What Happened to Your Face.
Oh, I thought it was the only things Hank said, because I would say, you know, explain it to me like I'm a fifth grader.
Oh, yeah, no, it is, but I'm just saying, What Happened to Your Face? I have AIDS. Oh,
okay, because so, it's part of that one.
Best soundtrack theme score, I'm gonna say no, because yes? Mike might lose his mind.
Okay, no, time out.
It's okay.
I think you should, first of all, you gotta put it in there.
I'm not the barometer, you know what I'm saying? I'm just one guy.
You're not the barometer until it comes to Interview with a Vampire, and you won't say no.
Well, no, Bill, that's Interview. I mean, that's a whole different story now. I mean, that's not a song. That's a whole movie.
This did lose the MTV Movie Award that year for Best Song.
To what?
What won?
So here are the nominees. I'm going to do the winner last.
This is so good. I want to go, can I watch this anywhere tonight on YouTube?
Some of them are topical to you, at least one other one. Celine Dion and Clive Griffin's When I Fall in Love from Sleepless in Seattle. Bruce Springsteen, Streets of Philadelphia. The Proclaimers, I'm Gonna Be, you know, 500 Miles from Benny and June. Good song. UB40's Can't Help Falling in Love from a movie called Silver.
Oh, with Sharon Stone?
Oh, yes. And then one of Kyle's favorite, All for Love from The Three Musketeers by Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart, and Sting. But the winner that year was Michael Jackson's Will You Be There from the movie Free Willy.
Oh,
no,
Willie, you be there. So, Mike, I've got good news and bad news. Bad news is that it does not look like you can watch this on YouTube. The 1992 VMAs are uploaded more than once on here. There are a lot of clips from 1993, but I don't think the entire ceremony is on YouTube. So I think you could probably piece together most of the ceremony, but not all in one fell swoop.
Wait, this was the 94 VMAs, though.
The last one I actually watched was 97, I think. Was that the Fiona Apple one? I think that's the last one where she, like, won, and she's like, this, everything here, this whole world, it's bullshit. it's bullshit, it's not real, it's fake, and she like walks off stage with her award. Awesome. Or something.
So if you go on YouTube and search 1994 VMAs, there's a 13 video playlist. There's the opening, there's Aerosmith performing Walk This Way, there's Warren G and Nate Dogg, there's Disarmed by the Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, so it's like the performance.
Oh, wait, the music. Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But it's not the VMAs, though, it's the movie awards.
Oh, MTV.
They're like popcorns and stuff.
I've been conflating those all night. All right, hold on. 1994 MTV Movie Awards commercial. Yeah, no, I don't think that there's...
It's not the end of the world. I got some OJ to finish watching.
No, sorry to disappoint. Best or worst love story? I'm going to say no. Like, it could have been him and Antonio Banderas, but I just don't feel like there's enough attention paid to it on purpose.
I mean, it could have been him and Denzel. It's, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. But they never really even... They just about form a friendship by the end of this, I'd say.
I don't know that this necessarily qualifies here. It does in a sense, and that's why I'm asking. Do we want to nominate this for most badass role for Tom Hanks? Like, I think what he does is courageous and badass, but I don't know that necessarily really embodies what we had in mind. I also don't know that Tom Hanks is going to have badass roles, and I feel like we're probably going to cut this category.
Well, I don't know. I feel like Castaway might win that, now that I think about it. Or I mean, even Sully is kind of badass.
Pretty
there's some shit down the line we're probably getting. I think in Cloud Atlas, he's definitely a badass in a couple of his
What's the one with Leonardo DiCaprio?
Catch Me If You Can. Yeah, he's a badass agent in that.
So then, on second thought, do you want to nominate this or no?
I don't think this quite makes the mark, though. Okay. I hear what you mean. Like, it's... the role is, but, like, I don't know. I feel like the category is more action-oriented for some reason, or... I don't know. Hard to say. Brian, thoughts?
I think there's going to be some more badass stuff. I think he does a badass thing, but I agree with you. I don't think that's in the spirit of the original category's intention.
And then final categories, best non-Hanks actor, male or female. We got to say Denzel Washington as Joe Miller.
Yeah, absolutely. Bradley Whitford.
I do like Bradley Whitford. I like Anna Deavere Smith, who plays his... she's the one on the stand who... is basically characterizes them as racist for saying her African earrings. I love her. She was in Nurse Jackie. She was the proprietor, the head of the hospital in Nurse Jackie. I loved her. There's a lot of good actors in this movie.
I noticed there's another guy. The guy who played the colonel in Boogie Nights is one of the guys who like runs the firm with Jason Robards. And Jason Robards is in Magnolia. So I was getting like a lot of this PTA crossover type of like vibe going on with this movie as far as like actors and stuff is concerned. But like, man, I can't get him as the colonel out of my head. So like, I knew he was like gonna be a slime ball in this movie, like a real jerk.
Robert Ridgely is his name, from Teaneck, New Jersey.
Ooh,
hey
Brian, do you have any other thoughts about Philadelphia before we wrap up and say farewell to you, and then Mike and I come back for Forrest Gump in 2 weeks?
I don't know. I just, this entire time, that Springsteen song has been in my head, and it's just, you know, it's getting to me in a good way. Let me check my notes. Nope, I'm good.
Mike, what about you? Any other last thoughts about Philadelphia?
I mean, maybe I've been a little too hard on the boss, Bruce Springsteen, there for a minute and stuff. I don't know. But, like, honestly, it just felt like designed for a movie kind of song. It would have been maybe if they found a song that already existed. I don't know.
But you can't win an award if you find a song.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, next week, Mike, we have Minority Report over on our Cruise Club feed. That's going to be very exciting. And then in 2 weeks, we've got Forrest Gump with our buddy. We've got two on there, but, you know, somebody who's been on both of our podcasts, on this one and on Brian's podcast, High School Summer Party, Walt Hickey is going to be on our Forrest Gump episode. So a movie that I'm not looking forward to. Like, this is a two-stretch. Like, I understand that this is all good Hanks movies. I was sort of dreading this one because of the weight, the content. I enjoyed it much more than I thought I was going to. I am not looking forward to rewatching Forrest Gump. 2 weeks, Forrest Gump. I mean, it's the back-to-back Oscars. We've got to give it the respect it's due and just kind of go from there. You know what I mean?
Guess so.
But Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know. I think this is your final. This is your farewell TomTom appearance.
Oh.
Unfortunately.
But you could get plenty of Brian as my unofficial co-host over on Third Time's a Charm. You can go check him out over there.
And on my show, High School Slumber Party, the week you release You've Got Mail, I will also be doing my You've Got Mail recap. So listen to this show, but also listen to my take on You've Got Mail, whatever week that is.
Is that going to be like in the beginning? I mean, what movie is that going to be for?
I don't know. Maybe it might be right in the middle, like hidden. You might get the record scratch and then...
Wait, I think I missed something. You're going to review You've Got Mail on your show?
Yeah, because you didn't let me review it on your show. And I love that movie. Come on, it's just some promo work, just some synergy in the network. It's going to...
Feb 7, 2020, the Friday after the Super Bowl, tune into High School Slumber Party for You've Got Mail?
Well, no, it's not the full episode, and I think I'll probably do it the week after, so I can listen to yours and be like, that was a bullshit take, guys. Here's the real story of You've
Got Mail. I don't know. You might be surprised. I think I'm going to like it.
Yeah, it's just that that movie is like my everyday commute. So, no, but I can't wait till you guys cover that, and goodbye, Tom Tom Club. Do you have a name for your listeners?
No, we don't have a name for the listeners.
Damn. Well, goodbye, people who like Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks. You can listen to me on High School Slumber Party.
But Brian, thank you so much for joining us and for joining us on all of these fine Tom Tom Club podcasts over these past few months.
Both these actors are still alive. I can still be on the show another time. It's all I'm saying, okay? I don't want to leave. You keep trying to kick me out. I don't want to go.
For all things Hanks for the Memories, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Come back next week on our Cruise Club feed for Minority Report. Check out last week's episode of Vanilla Sky, Abre los Ojos. And come back in 2 weeks for Forrest Gump when we talk about podcasting being like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Brian Late Night Rodriguez at the High School Slumber Party, and now I guess Third Time's a Charm, and also PSA Love Hoffman podcast. And we'll see you next time right here on Hanks for the Memories.
I was bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh, brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia?
I have a case.